In the Buddhist teaching, he often used analogies and similes. As a way of conveying his teaching, he was kind of a master of these analogies. They're so evocative and work on so many different levels often that the image or the simile that he uses can resonate for us in our practice, different times, different ways, different depths even, touching us in different ways at different times. And it can be interesting to unpack these analogies a little bit, to reflect on them, to explore their meaning in terms of their imagery and their words. And then the analogy or the simile itself can speak to us in a different way than didactic words do. I think that the analogies, the similes, can touch us at a different level. He often used water for some of his similes. Many different ways that water comes up in the Buddhist similes, and one particular analogy he used several times is a simile for our suffering being like a flood. And this resonates with us even these days. I mean, we speak in that language even. I'm drowning in experience, or I don't feel like I can keep my head above water. And so this imagery it seems very human to us. The imagery of the flood, of being swept away by a flood of water, or drowning in misery or suffering. And so the flood in these similes does refer, we can just say it refers to the flood of our suffering. And the suffering we often think, well, maybe it often feels as though the conditions of that suffering are external to us. And very often pieces of that suffering are external to us. Ways that other people relate to us, things that they do, other things that happen in the world, all of these things contribute to the ways in which we feel like we're swept away or drowning. And yet the pointing that the Buddha offered us. And again, I think I talked about this the other night, that stuff happens in the world. And yes, we engage. We don't simply settle back. It's not just that we, last night in the reflecting on allowing. Allowing not necessarily meaning non-doing or non-action. And so this allowing of all of these conditions, and essentially we do explore, allow whatever's here to be here, but that allowing what's here to be here is not, it's not about settling back and saying, oh yeah, things as they are, that's the way it is. You know, kind of like a non-active mode around what happens in the world. Allowing really speaks to recognizing that what is happening is happening. It's already here. And the allowing part is about not denying what's here, being here, but then with our hearts meeting that with some degree of balance, with that allowing quality. The allowing doesn't mean that we just kind of settle back and say, well, that's the way it is. The allowing allows us to step into the next moment with a heart that's connected rather than a heart that's resistant, a heart that's motivated by compassion and wisdom and patience rather than hatred, fear, aversion. And so the suffering that we meet, meeting that suffering with allowing, does not mean non-action. And so there is this stuff happening in the world. And the Buddha pointed to the flood itself, or the suffering itself, being not what is happening in the world, but rather the way in which we are relating to it. The greed, the aversion, the confusion, the resistance, the fear, the anger, all of those reactive states of mind. That's the flood. The experience of the flood is connected to all of the stuff that's happening. But the flood itself lies in our relationship to it. That's where we drown. That's where we sink. That's where we get swept away. And so we can think about the flood being really the flood of greed, aversion, and delusion in our minds. And that is a succinct definition of what the Buddha said suffering is, and the freedom that's possible when he talked about the freedom of the third noble truth, Nibbana. One way he defined Nibbana, he said, Nibbana, the absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion, this is Nibbana, this is freedom, this is release. This is where the flood ends. And so the flood that can be crossed, and this is the analogy that one of the analogies to explore is crossing this flood. And so this flood can be crossed. The greed, aversion, delusion can release. So the sutta, this is a short sutta that I wanted to share today. And I've mentioned it a couple times already, briefly. And so on one occasion, the Buddha was staying in Jetta's grove, and this being came to him. And approaching the Buddha, said, "How, dear sir, did you cross the flood?" And the Buddha responded, "By not halting, friend, and by not straining, I crossed the flood." "But how is it, dear sir, that by not halting and not straining you cross the flood?" When I came to a standstill, friend, then I sank. But when I struggled, then I got swept away. It is in this way, friend, that by not halting and not straining, I cross the flood. Another translation uses tarrying and hurrying instead of halting and straining. And that language is very evocative for this mind, for my own mind. And so this is an important thing to recognize actually in general in your practice, is language having a very powerful effect on our minds. Certain language will be very evocative, supporting our practice. Certain language will, arising in the mind, pull us right into reactivity. And so there's certain language, at times there's certain language that will really resonate for us. In the group, somebody mentioned that today, a particular way of asking a question. One way wasn't quite so helpful. Another way was really helpful. And so I want to encourage you to find the language that supports you. And so for myself, in this other translation, by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I cross the flood. Maybe because tarrying and hurrying feels more evocative to me around how my mind works. So by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I cross the flood. So this teaching is really short. First of all, you know, the Buddha, in hearing this question to him, how did you cross the flood? It's like that was evocative to him. That language of flood was evocative to him. He didn't have to stop and say, now what do you mean by flood? It's like, yeah, I get it. I know what you mean. Experience feels like it floods us. We are drowning in our suffering. And so immediately the Buddha resonated with that image of the flood and had a response. Like the flood, I crossed the flood, crossed over this greed, aversion, delusion, crossed over this suffering by neither tarrying nor hurrying. And so here at this, a piece that is interesting, I think, is what the Buddha is pointing to here is not the what of experience, but how. How did he meet experience? So this is really a very succinct teaching on how to be on the path, if we can understand what it means by neither tarrying nor hurrying, by neither halting nor straining, by neither stopping nor rushing. It's the how we meet experience that is important, not what is being met. Looking at Sayadaw's language of wise attitude, of finding that way of meeting experience, where the mind is at ease with whatever is happening. That's essentially the same thing as neither tarrying nor hurrying. The mind meeting each experience, moment after moment, at ease with what's here, neither needing to stop and look at things, figure things out, rush by it, get past it, at ease with whatever arises, moment after moment. And so this teaching, by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I cross the flood, is kind of a description of how the Buddha found his way to wise attitude. The being goes on to ask, so Okay, neither tarrying nor hurrying. Why did that? What? Say more. And the Buddha added a little bit more, not a lot, but a little bit more, and said, "By tarrying, when I tarried, I sank. When I came to a standstill, I sank. When I hurried, I got swept away. When I struggled, I got swept away." And it is in this way that by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I cross the flood. So another piece here to kind of highlight in this is, it's inspiring. To me, it feels inspiring, this description. When I tarried, I sank. When I hurried, I swept away. I got swept away. The Buddha is describing that he tarried on the path. He drowned. He spent time underwater. He found himself rushing, hurrying, and got swept away. He found himself drifting off down the stream, not quite connected. The Buddha, in his path, sank and got swept away. He was human. And he didn't just let that like overwhelm him. It's like, okay, this tarrying, you know, so the connection, it feels the connection that he made was, when I tarried, I sank. The drowning feeling wasn't about all the stuff that was happening. It was the stopping, the halting, the tarrying that created the sinking. It wasn't all the stuff around me that swept me away. It was the hurrying that created the conditions for sweeping me away. And so again, pointing to not necessarily that it's not necessarily about all of those external conditions, but the relationship. And so in seeing that condition, tarrying, sinking, hurrying, swept away, rather than trying to change or rather than trying to navigate the world by creating conditions different in the world, he looked at the conditions in his own mind. What is there that is under kind of agency of this being? What does this being have agency over? And there is this agency over or around how we are in relationship. And partly that agency arrives or comes up through the witnessing, through seeing. When the mind engages in this way, when there's this stuff happening and the mind in relationship in this way, sinking happens. So that experience of sinking happening, recognizing it's connected intimately to how the mind is relating to it. It's like, let's look at what is there the possibility of change here? And actually the very seeing of that connection, the very seeing that this action of tarrying, sinking happens, the seeing of that connection, the mind through that kind of movement towards well-being that very naturally our minds have. Seeing that connection, the mind begins to get, well, that's not necessarily a skillful response to that situation. And so it starts to engage differently. Maybe starts to neither tarry nor hurry. And so the Buddha in his own journey looked at what conditions in the world, what conditions arising in the mind, where was it? And it's the mindfulness that helps us to recognize, the mindfulness helps us to see what participation in our own mind leads to more suffering, and what participation in our mind takes us away from suffering. And that creates the movement, the agency in the mind then wants to move in the direction of less suffering, letting go of that habit or pattern of tarrying or hurrying. So there's a lot of different ways tarrying and hurrying can be understood. And reflecting on this, it feels like the quality of tarrying and hurrying, these qualities of tarrying and hurrying, kind of are a different way of looking at how we relate to experience. So we've talked about wise attitude and checking the relationship to experience, and these various flavors of experience will be one of greed, aversion, or delusion. And there will be greed, aversion, or delusion, or this balance of mind there. But this tarrying or hurrying feels like a kind of a different way. It's like a different way of looking at the whole question of attitude. So tarrying can be connected to greed, wanting to kind of, oh, this is pretty cool, let me stay here and look at this for a little while, getting kind of stuck to something. Or it might be related to aversion. Oh, this is really bad, I better figure out how to fix this. So the tarrying with something, kind of getting stuck to something, landing with it and over, kind of over emphasizing it in a way. Maybe greed, maybe aversion. And yet there is a kind of a quality in the mind that this tarrying and hurrying maybe points to. So the quality of kind of landing and getting stuck somewhere is the tarrying quality. And whether there's greed in the mind or aversion in the mind, that quality of tarrying has a particular flavor, a particular kind of sense. And so it's another way maybe to begin to recognize the mind a little bit out of balance, recognizing this. Like wrapped up into a whirlpool or kind of stuck to something. Just familiarity with that experience of having to be, having to stay with something, tarrying with it. And hurrying, likewise, can be greed, aversion. We might, with aversion, kind of rush past experience because we don't like it. Or we might rush or hurry with greed, like, you know, so anxious to get to the pleasant things that we're not really landing here with what's here. So again, there's this quality of rushing, of hurrying, of straining, of pushing in that way. There's a kind of a feeling to that, that maybe we can start landing with what does it mean in experience? Meeting experience in this way of neither tarrying nor hurrying. Other ways to reflect on these qualities, tarrying, maybe connected with the feeling of a sleepy mind, a dull mind, that hindrance of sloth and torpor. Hurrying connected to restless mind, these qualities of sinking and rushing. Very resonant with the imagery of neither tarrying nor hurrying. And yet it's important to recognize that So while the Buddha did say, by neither tarrying nor hurrying I cross the flood, in some interesting way, like for instance, we might think, okay, sloth and torpor, that's tarrying. And it is when the mind is caught by sloth and torpor, when the mind is caught in that dullness, when the mind is sunk into it, that's tarrying. And yet, when the mind can be aware of that, this is the experience of sloth and torpor. There's no longer the sinking. There is the simple recognition. This is what it's like to be a human being experiencing dullness, sleepiness, spaciness. Right there, you're no longer tarrying. There's already a shift in the mind. And so, to me, this neither tarrying nor hurrying piece is really pointing to the meeting of experience, whatever it is. Even if the experience is tarrying or hurrying, oh, tarrying is happening. That changes the dynamic immediately. That's what's going on. Getting familiar with that quality, what it feels like to tarry or hurry, rush. There's another sutta. Many of you are familiar with the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta on the Foundations of Mindfulness. I like Ganalio's translation, the Establishments of Mindfulness. That title, again, language resonates certain ways, not others. Foundation feels like something like we're landing on. Establishment feels more active. Establishing mindfulness, that's what we're doing with this teaching. The Buddha points to ways to support establishing this presence, this continuity of mindfulness. And so in this teaching on the establishing of mindfulness, four ways of establishing mindfulness. The third way he points to is looking at the mind. And this is very resonant with this particular style of practice, this third foundation of mindfulness. And in that section, just paraphrased here, the Buddha says something like, and how does one observe the mind as the mind? When there is greed arising in the mind, one knows there is greed arising in the mind. When greed is not arising in the mind, one knows greed is not arising in the mind. When aversion is arising, one knows there is not aversion. When aversion is arising, one knows there is aversion arising in the mind. When there's not aversion, one knows there's not aversion arising in the mind. Very simple description here of just noticing what's here. The teaching, that little section, does not say when aversion is arising in the mind, figure out how to get rid of it. It says, one knows aversion is arising in the mind. We've talked about this piece of recognizing that the shift that happens in the mind, when the mind recognizes a defilement, when the mind recognizes reactivity, when it recognizes greed, recognizes aversion, recognizes delusion arising in the mind, that's very different than being caught by the greed, the aversion, the delusion. And so this is that place where the mind can be balanced, can know. Greed is arising in the mind. Greed is not arising in the mind. And there are times when it's not that simple. And we do need to take some action because we're not able to just know, oh yeah, that's greed. Oh yeah, that's aversion. So sometimes we're not able to know that. But this is the pointing of this sutta, that possibility of just being able to see, oh, this is greed arising, and this is aversion arising. And implicit in that is the value of that. That perspective of being able to witness greed or aversion arising in the mind, neither tarrying nor hurrying with it, creates the conditions for a transformation, for a releasing of that reactivity. That same mindfulness also creates the conditions when we see non-greed or non-aversion arising in the mind, for that to strengthen. It's a beautiful quality, this quality of mindfulness, this same witnessing when there is an unwholesome state, an unskillful state arising in the mind. This witnessing, oh yeah, that's what's arising, creates the conditions for it to weaken, creates the conditions for it to arise less frequently. Partly because our mind gets the suffering of it, gets that this is something the mind is doing, that the mind is adding to the experience. The mind is participating in that suffering. And so the seeing of that, the mind begins to let that go. And on the other side, the seeing of, the witnessing of love and compassion and non-greed, non-aversion, creates the conditions, because our system, in seeing that and meeting that, the system begins to recognize, yes, this is the way to well-being. This is helpful. We don't even have to tell ourselves this is helpful. Our system knows this is helpful, and our system inclines in that direction. And so this very same simple practice, what's here? What's arising? Oh, aversion's arising? Know that. Love is arising? Know that. Aversion will weaken. Love will strengthen. It's the nature of how our minds work. And so this is a great thing. And we also need to recognize when our minds don't have that capacity to simply recognize this is what's happening in this moment. We've talked about that, of you know, really this aspect of recognizing and honoring when the mind is not in a place to simply witness, then bringing in some of our tools to help the mind balance. The tools that you know already, you have tools in your toolkit to help you balance your mind from your other practices. You're welcome to use those when the mind can't simply meet the experience. And yet, give yourself that opportunity. Give yourself that chance to meet experience. More often than we think, we are capable of that. Another piece of this third foundation is the phrase, one knows the contracted mind as contracted mind, and one knows the distracted mind as distracted mind. this language, contracted, distracted, feels like it maps pretty directly onto tarrying and hurrying. When the mind is contracted and kind of inward, stuck on something, that's like the tarrying, where we tend to sink. The distracted mind, the mind that's kind of all over the place, jumping around and not able to stay connected moment to moment to experience, that has the quality, connected to the quality of rushing. And as the teaching here points, when contracted mind is arising, one knows contracted mind is arising. When distracted mind is arising, one knows distracted mind is arising. Again, pointing to the power of the awareness to change the equation completely. And so, kind of underneath the surface of this analogy is, so by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I cross the flood. It's not exactly that you had to stop the tarrying or do something different other than, oh, tarrying is happening. The mind is contracted right now. And knowing that, distracted, the mind is hurrying right now, knowing that. We may not be able to stop the tarrying or hurrying. But perhaps we can know it. This is contracted mind. And again, meeting contracted mind, knowing contracted mind as contracted mind, the mind begins to feel the suffering of that and understanding that the contraction is something that this mind is doing in its own its own place. The mind starts to understand how to let that contraction go. The mind begins to understand how to neither tarry nor hurry. We often have no idea how to shift the mind in that way. It's feeling the contraction and the holding and the clinging. You know, we can feel that and recognize, yeah, this is suffering, and have no idea how to let it go. And we do not have to do the letting go. Sometimes we can. Sometimes there can be a kind of a recognition of, oh, wow, yeah, the mind is clinging to that. And the very seeing of that, and there might be a kind of, maybe it's not quite so sticky, so we can say, yeah, maybe I should put my attention over here, or maybe I can let go of this a little bit. And so sometimes there can be a letting go of something that's really sticky like that. Sometimes there can be a little bit of agency around that, but other times we may just be sitting in that place of, yeah, this is clinging and this hurts. And if I knew how to let go of it, I would, but I have no idea. Those moments take some trust. Trust that the witnessing of it is a learning, that there is a learning that's happening there. And maybe the main learning that's happening is clinging is suffering. That's not a mistake, actually. That's a big learning that we have got to get. Clinging is suffering. Joseph sometimes says something along the lines of, you know, we want to experience freedom from suffering without experiencing the suffering. And it doesn't work that way. It is through the experience of the suffering, it is through the meeting of that suffering, that the mind begins to understand how to let go. And that comes back to this image of neither tarrying nor hurrying. Just that image of the flood, the flood of greed, aversion, delusion, the flood of suffering. And we're crossing the flood. In this image, you know, I have this image of like the Buddha walking just step after step across the flood. He didn't say, I crossed the flood by floating up and hovering across the whole way, never touching that suffering. Every moment, meeting, meeting, meeting. We get to know that suffering by neither tarrying nor hurrying. We might tend to stop and sink, then we really get that flavor of suffering. Or hurry and get swept away. And again, another feeling, a different kind of feeling of suffering there. But this neither tarrying nor hurrying, it's a different relationship to the suffering. But it's not not experiencing the suffering. We still experience, and in some ways know more intimately, the way greed, aversion, and delusion affect the mind. More intimately how that creates struggle and stress in the mind. Because before we have been just buying into need to get that thing, need to get rid of that thing, and kind of missing that the very movement of needing to get or needing to get rid of itself is suffering. We have bought into the belief of that aversion, the belief, the delusion that underlies aversion, that if I get rid of that thing, then I'll be happy. And there is a kind of happiness that can result when we get rid of something that we don't like. But the Buddha pointed to that kind of happiness as being a pretty fleeting kind of happiness. It lasts for only a little while until the mind finds something else it needs to get rid of or needs to hold on to. And then we're right back in that dissatisfaction. We're right back in that suffering. And so this buying into the delusion, buying into the belief that aversion has, the belief that greed has, having this will make me happy, getting rid of this will make me happy, we miss. It's like we are giving over the ease and peace in this moment for the possibility that in some future moment I will get that thing or get rid of that thing, and then I'll be happy. And not seeing that in this moment already there is dissatisfaction. The arising of aversion is already suffering. The arising of wanting is already suffering. And so the mindfulness, this is that shift, neither tarrying nor hurrying. We feel, oh yeah, the arising of greed is, that is suffering. It's not a mistake. It's actually where the learning happens, where the mind begins to turn and shift to choosing another way. So this image of neither tarrying nor hurrying, each moment, this moment, this moment, the next thing, the next experience, contacting, meeting that, but then not staying stuck. This image of the Buddha just walking at a very even pace across suffering, very inspiring to me. The mind able to hold whatever is there, whatever is presented. On a recent retreat, this image of neither tarrying nor hurrying, it was my teacher, actually. It kept, on most of my self-retreats, there's some phrase or some poem or something that comes up that repeats, and it becomes a teacher. And I just finished a self-retreat a month or so ago, and this phrase, by neither tarrying nor hurrying, was the phrase that kept coming up. And at many levels, it would be arising and it would just speak to whatever was happening in that moment. Some little flavor of stuckness to something, or some little flavor of, oh yeah, got that, check, move on. Just a little bit of rushing, a little bit of tarrying, just seeing how the mind, in even very subtle ways, does this tarrying and hurrying, and kind of even landing in a concept or a belief where the mind kind of takes hold of something and picks it up and then is seeing through that. You know, this belief, a belief of something, you know, this is the way things are, that's kind of a form of tarrying. Stuck to some view. And so this image would come up and it would be resonant and supportive in the moment, allowing the mind to see something in a new way. Perhaps recognizing a way in which I was tarrying that I hadn't recognized. And at some point on this retreat, this image of the Buddha crossing the flood was in the mind. And it shifted. The image kind of shifted from, you know, there's this rush, this flood of water in the image, this just like stream of water flowing by, and the Buddha walking like on the water, neither tarrying nor hurrying. And it's like each step, as the Buddha took a step, it'd be like there'd be some kind of like landing. He didn't sink. He didn't get swept away. It's like, oh, there's a landing. It's almost like out of the flood grew some like place where there for a moment was a place that there could be contact and stability, and then moving on. Just this image of neither tarrying nor hurrying. Just meet and the next thing. And then it shifted even further, this image that the Buddha was no longer crossing a flood, but was just walking. And there's this understanding of the tarrying and hurrying create the flood. When we no longer tarry nor hurry, there is no longer a flood. And this is the work of finding wise attitude. We get to know how to neither tarry nor hurry by sometimes tarrying and sinking, by sometimes hurrying and getting swept away, recognizing the conditions of that. Sayadaw points to with wise attitude. We get to know wise attitude. We find our way to wise attitude by getting to know unwise attitude really well. And this points back to that third foundation. When greed is arising, we know greed is arising. When aversion is arising, we know aversion is arising. And when they're not arising, we know that too. And in the finding of that place, neither tarrying nor hurrying, the mind at balance, at ease, with whatever's happening, that is the place where freedom can be found. The absence of greed, the absence of aversion, the absence of delusion, this is freedom. Let's just sit for a few minutes. How, dear sir, did you cross the flood? By neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed the flood. But how is it, dear sir, that by neither tarrying nor hurrying you crossed the flood? When I tarried, friend, I sank. When I hurried, I got swept away. In this way, friend, by neither tarrying nor hurrying, I crossed the flood. Thank you for your attention.